This is The Positive Mind with Armand DeMille here on WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial. Normally heard Tuesdays and Wednesdays at 1 p.m. right here in the center of your dial, but today a two-hour special. A short while ago, we were offering a premium, and the premium was this consultation, a chance to meet with me, and I met with a man. His name is Henry Morales. Henry grew up in the streets. He grew up in the streets of Brooklyn around the Fort Greene area, but in the roughest parts, without a family, living a prison life. Here's a man who admits that he has killed men, he has stolen, he has done everything possible, and he is spending the rest of his life trying to be good to people. Let me introduce you to Henry Morales and the journey of the streets, the life of the streets. You're going to hear some things that are going to be shocking to you and surprising to you. Guest in the studio, Henry Morales. Henry Morales came to us. Well, let me introduce you to Henry. Henry, say hello to the WBAI audience.
Hello, WBAI.
Yeah, WBAI has been with you for a long time.
Yes, they have.
Tell me about your experience with WBAI first.
Well, I think the first time I started listening to WBAI was in the 70s, and I was in Bridgeport Correctional Facility. I think I was in there for a bank robbery. Mm-hmm. And I just was listening to the station, and I was just impressed with the things that they were saying.
How did it get to you in the 70s in the prison? Were other people listening?
Very few.
How did you know of it?
I don't recall how I initially ran into it, but when I did, it hooked me.
It hooked you, right. So you began listening while you're in the correctional facility, right. And it's an educational station.
Yes, it is.
What were you listening to? Which were the programs? There was a Saturday program, which was...
Wow. I'm sure it was with the politics concerning Fred Hampton, Black Panthers, and that sort of stuff, and what was going on then. There was the same continuous argument over the Kennedy assassinations, mm-hmm. a number of other things in that area.
So there you are in a correctional facility for having done a bank robbery, right? This is one of the arrests or one of a number of arrests, because you've done a number of bank robberies, right?
Yes, I have.
Yeah. And so how much of your life has been spent, say, up until the age of 45? How much of your life was spent in a correctional facility?
Approximately 20 years.
20 out of the 45?
Yes.
Now, what about the early, early years?
Well, they were also institutional years. But,
right, and those are institutional
orphanage,
years?
Orphanage, youth house, a boys' home, conservation camp, just a litany of places,
Every place where you didn't have a family. So you were kind of taken away. So right from the beginning, up until the age of from you were kind of tossed out into the streets, and from the streets, you were brought into some kind of an institution of some sort. And then from there, you had to learn what life was about.
Correct.
And yes. When did you learn you had to really fend for yourself? At what age?
Well, I've always been fending for myself as far back as I can remember.
From age five.
I went to the orphanage at around 5, 6 years old.
Yeah.
And I left the orphanage at, St. Dominic's in Blauvelt, New York.
Uh-huh.
At the age of 12, graduated out of the 8th grade, and they sent me to a place in Brooklyn called St. Vincent's Home for Boys.
Now, you were always getting in trouble, though, because you were not...
I was always having trouble adjusting to my surroundings, and to the people around me. I don't know why.
A lot of fights.
Just a lot of fights, yeah.
A lot of fights.
A lot of beat downs,
Beat down, meaning you got counselors.
Oh, yes.
They beat some down
boys
on you.
Yes, yeah. Because I was always a loner. I never joined a gang or anything of that nature, There was gangs all around me, but I just couldn't find a way to join a gang.
Is it that you didn't fit into a gang?
Well, because of the orphanage, St. Dominic's, I was what you might call naive, though I was a bad kid in the convent. When I got to New York City, it was, you really saw what bad was. I wasn't even close to it, you know. So I had a hard time adjusting with the people I was associating with. I didn't curse, you know, and I spoke in a funny way, you know, and I stuttered, you know. So I kind of kept to myself.
So you stuttered. You were about of average size, right? You're now people listening, they don't know your nationality, even though it does says Morales. You are.
I am a Puerto Rican. You know, uh-huh. I'm a black Puerto Rican. That's how I see myself.
You're black Puerto Rican, so therefore you have all of that stereotype going towards you as well. And here you are in the streets. Now, what happened to your parents?
Actually, I don't know exactly what happened to them. I know that my mother supposedly died when I was six, but she had been in the hospital for quite some time. And my father was already gone. I have no idea what happened to him.
Did you know who he was?
I don't see him in my mind's eye.
You can't even imagine who he was. Just no. Stories you may have heard about
right,
him.
Right, right. It's hard to tell my story without involving other people, other forces that were involved.
Go ahead, tell the story.
And the story is that there was a woman by the name of Oquendo, and she was what you call a brujería in Latin culture, which is like a bad witch.
Yeah.
And she was the midwife in all of our births, my mother's births, which were four. We had four siblings.
So she was the midwife to all of your mother's
yes, children,
births,
yes.
Who yes. were the, your, you and your three siblings.
Yes, yes.
Right, so she's a midwife.
And then, though I had no recollection of who she was, when I was in the convent, one of the counselors called us down and said, someone's here to see you, me and my sister, Connie. My brother had been given to Oquendo at birth. So I really didn't know him, and he was being raised by Oquendo. So when my mother got sick, the welfare stepped in, took us and put us in the convent. And then Oquendo came to visit us sometime later and told us that our mother had died, and that was it, you know, and that she didn't, when she was dying, she didn't know us, she didn't know our names and didn't recognize us or anything like that. So... I mean, that's how I found out my mother's birth. We didn't go to a funeral or anything like that.
That's how you found out your mother was dead.
My mother had passed.
So when your mother was sick, they put you in the convent.
Yes.
And then Oquendo was, she was the brujería. How do you pronounce it again?
A brujería.
Brujería, right. Which is like a witch.
She's
a witch, right? And she's kind of like not a nice lady. And what she does is she keeps your brother. Right, because she's getting probably welfare money for that.
I found out years later that she was getting money for all four of us, and she had been getting it since my mother had passed.
Since your mother had passed.
Yes. And while we were in the convent, she took my two sisters after a year or so out of the convent, gave them to her two sons, who were 25 and 30 years older than my sisters, who were also married men, and just gave them as slaves, you know.
And she kept the welfare for it.
Right, and they never went to school, and these men just used and abused them. One of my sisters had six kids before she was 21. The other one had four. They both had their first children at 13.
So they were having sex somewhere around 10 years old, 11 years old with
these people who were supposed to be my uncles.
Who were your uncles.
But they weren't really my uncles. They were Oquendo's sons.
Right.
And so
they treated your sisters like they were just an object. Now, one of your sisters eventually, you found out, wound up in a what eventually happened to her?
Well,
Connie.
Well, Connie now is still a functioning adult. You know, she lives somewhere in Manhattan. I haven't seen her in a number of years. And the other one, Gladys, is somewhere in Brooklyn. I just recently found out that Gladys... her health is not well. Actually, she has, I don't know if I should mention, but she has AIDS, you know, and I just recently found that out. But she had the hardest time out of all of us, I believe, because she was the youngest, and she never learned to read and write, never went to school, you know. Connie at least had, I think, eighth grade, like myself, eighth grade education, you know, and so she was able to function a little better.
Now all this is taking place up in Harlem, in
All this is taking place in Brooklyn, downtown Brooklyn.
All downtown. You're brought up in downtown Brooklyn.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay, mm-hmm. So that's where your childhood is. You have no mother. You get out in the streets. And even when you did have a mother, you were getting in trouble right back then, didn't you? Wasn't there a fire starter?
Yes, I had problems of starting a fire starter. You know, I started a couple of fires, and one was the cause of some stitches over my eye when I had to jump out of a first story.
Tell that story. You were with a friend of yours.
There was a neighbor of ours, Virginia, who lived upstairs, and she had a 10-year-old son, so 4 or 5 years older than I was at the time, and I was about four. And we were outside playing one day, and he came downstairs and said, come on, let's take a walk. I want to show you something. And I, you know, just went along with him, you know. And we got to the corner, and I was nervous about crossing the street. But he said, come on, we're just going to take a second. Come on, let's go. So I went along with him, and just a couple of buildings over after we crossed the street was an abandoned building. And we went in there, we were playing with matches, and we wound up setting the place on fire and trying to get out. We couldn't go out the way we got in, so we had to go up to the first landing. And the fire was just starting to overwhelm us. So he kicked the window open, you know, and then he jumped out, and then he told me to jump. And to me, it was the wrong way, but I was either jump or burn. So I jumped, and I landed on a nail that was sticking out of a stick into my eye. And when I pulled it out, the blood just started gushing out. And he grabbed me, and we steered me across the street. And then when he got across the street, he just let me go down the block and had to walk down the block myself with all the stuff coming out of my eye.
4 years old, black Puerto Rican kid, blood gushing out of his eyes, running down the streets, a fire ablaze somewhere, fire engines coming, and people noticed. They said, I saw that kid.
Yeah, and right away, well, my sister was still playing out there with her friends, and she saw me first, and she started yelling, and then my mother came out of the house, and she put the whole thing together and grabbed me and brought me inside and beat me. and I don't know if she really realized how bad the wound was.
She beat you while the blood was coming out of your
eye. And she gave me a rag to hold over it, you know. And then sometime later, I was about an hour, half hour or so later, I was in the bathroom, almost passed out. And her boyfriend at the time came in, and, you know, he saw the blood and saw me almost out. So he grabbed me, threw me in the back of his car in this race, running every light to the hospital where they stitched me up, cleaned it out, and told me I got there in time, you know. So that's how I started out.
4 years old.
Yes, you know, but that's what you do in urban areas, you know. It's not like going out in the suburbs where more access to...
Yeah, Henry, you know? But it's not what everybody does. It was this is the roughest of the rough. I grew up in a neighborhood not very far from yours. And we had it rough, but it wasn't like this. We had parents around who were at least, they had the idea of being a parent. You were alone. You were 4 years old. You're alone in that street. You got sisters to take care of. You got stuff hanging around you, and you have a brother, right?
Yes, yes, yes. But he wasn't living with us.
He wasn't living with you at all.
Yes, it was many years later when I became aware of who he was.
So as you're growing up, you start learning, this is going to be rough. And here am I, a kid who stutters, who's going to be beat all over the place. Adults beat you.
Yes.
Now, this is a story that I remember from my own childhood. Adults used to beat us. It was like something about being a kid. You got beat. You know, it's like the priest beat me, the everybody hit you.
Well, I was conditioned in the convent. Right. With the nuns and the counselors there, so...
Everybody hits you.
Yeah, all regular.
That's the way life is. I'm a child, and adults beat me.
And sometimes you get beat a little more than others, but, you know...
And how do you deal with being beat? What do you do when you're being beat? You cover yourself up, you run away, or you make yourself not feel it?
Well, after a while, you get used to it.
That's right.
You know, after a while, I knew, okay, this is just going to last a few more minutes, you know, then it'll be over. Let me cry and yell a little more. Maybe I can act a little more. And it comes to
what do
end,
they want to stop? If they want me to cry, I'll cry. If they want me to shut up, I'll shut up. But what's he going to do to get this to stop?
Yes, and whatever it took, that's what.
Yeah, different strategies with different people.
Yes, correct. Yeah. You know, so.
Okay, so you're going through all of this and you're getting beating, but now physical beatings are a part of life. And you go from 4 years old to 5 years old to 6 years old to 7 years old, and suddenly you're at 10 years old and there are kids 8 years old. And it's like kind of interesting because now you have somebody to beat.
That's exactly what happens. You know, I started reaching back, and it's not only that, there was a number of other abuses that went on. But I can assure you, everything that was done to me, I did to others.
Among the abuses,
sexual abuse, everything.
And you're forced into sexual situations?
Yes, yes. And that's going back to before I even went to the convent, when I was four, you know. And that same kid who was the son of Virginia, who lived up over my mother's house, and even her herself. And I don't know if we would call it abuse. I mean, you call it abuse now, but in those days, it wasn't abuse. When she used to, like, pull my pants down and play with me, you know, and actually kiss and you know, just down there, you know. You know, and then her son, exact same thing, you know. So
she did the same with her son, or her son?
No, she did.
Same
her son also
did that with you.
Yes.
So they're playing with you sexually, right. And you're 4 years old, 5 years old, 6 years old. So sex becomes a mixture of pleasure and weirdness.
Weirdness, yes. But I know that once I got in the convent, it was pleasure. But I think it was more than that when I look at it in retrospect. And I was looking for something to feel good because I had everything around me feeling bad.
Yeah.
You know, so.
So sex felt good.
Yes.
And in the convent.
And it's always been an escape for me my whole life.
Yes. You know? And so in the convent, as a kid, most kids masturbate a lot, and that's an escape that makes them feel good.
Yes. And you find that a lot of other kids are doing the same thing. You know, I mean, it's prevalent, you know. It's
a common thing.
It's very common.
There's
even
a thing called circle jerks. Did you ever hear of that expression?
Circle jerks.
Yeah, that's where a bunch of guys would get together and they would just
masturbate. I know. Not to that extent, but you know, at night if you wake up, you might see this guy over there in somebody else's bed, and you know, you can see what's going on, and
sex with another boy would be more like, it doesn't have to be that kind of penetration. It could be like sliding between arms and legs and stuff like that.
All that stuff, you know.
All of that just to get the release that comes with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then, you know, because they kept us separated from girls, we would never see girls, you know. And so, you know, so all you have is boys. You know? Mm-hmm. So it may make you question who you are, you know. Though I never questioned myself, you know, because when I got to 12 years old and I was sent to St. Vincent's Home for Boys, immediately girls were available, and then, you know, they dominated everything.
We're speaking with Henry Morales. Henry Morales is the author of Journey of a Man, a book that is made possible by his being able to sit down and finally put his life in a short 200-page journal. It's beautifully written, and it's captivating. Journey of a Man is made available to you for a donation to WBAI. For a $75 donation to WBAI, we will send you a signed copy by Henry Morales himself. It's something that touches you. It's something that you should have, something you should know about. You're going to be hearing more about this as we go through this program. It's captivating. With a $75 donation, you can get a copy of, we will send you a copy of Journey of a Man by Henry Morales, signed copy. And it's a donation to the station that he talks about. Now, Henry first heard about us in prison. When he was in prison and he was listening to WBAI. And it is through there that he became to appreciate our station, and it is through there that he is now here on air with us, giving back to the station. Our telephone number is 212-757-4488. That's 212-757-4488. For a $75 donation, if you make a donation of $75 to the station, you become a member to WBAI, and you will get a copy of Journey of a Man, a book by Henry Morales. It's a beautiful thing to read and to pass on and to send to people. You know, so many of you feel like you've lived a privileged life, and you haven't had any idea of what it really is like on the inside. This is Henry's book. What you're hearing during this interview is just a small piece of what we're able to, of what's in the book. It's amazing, amazing. 212-757-4488. For a different donation to the station, for a $200 donation, yes, believe it or not, for a $200 donation, you get a chance to explore your own journey, and that's a chance to meet with me personally, Armand DeMille, at my offices here on 57th Street in Manhattan, 212-757-4488, during this fund drive, the WBAI fund drive, raising money to keep the station alive, as we have been doing all year. Our backs have been broken, and it hasn't stopped us one bit. We're just standing up to all of them. One of the things I love about Henry Morales is that nothing broke his back. 212-757-4488 for a $200 donation. Is your back being broken, or do you feel your back weakening? Come meet with me for a half hour or 45 minutes, and let's meet. Let's talk. Let's find out what we could do to make your life a little better, a little stronger, or perhaps encourage you to get the kind of courage that you would like to have in your life. Encourage. That's a good word, encourage you, as in to give you courage. 212-757-4488, 212-757-4488. Please make your calls right now. 212-757-4488. For a $200 donation, you get a one-time meeting with me, Armand DeMille. And for a $75 donation, you get a copy of the book Journey of a Man by Henry Morales. 212-757-4488. 212-757-4488. Julian?
And that's a $200 donation for the consultation that everybody's been talking about with Armand DeMille. $200 donation and the $75 donation to read more about Henry Morales and this story of understanding. So call now, 212-757-4488, 212-757-4488. We're going to be standing here to hear your calls and take down your information and get this going. So The Journey of a Man by Henry Morales, $75 donation and $200 for the consultation.
212-757-4488. 212-757-4488.
212-757-4488. 212-757-4488. For a $200 donation, you get to meet with Armand. And for a $75 donation, you get to read the story by Henry Morales called Street Life.
Hey, you know, you're in the studio here as we're doing this, Alex. What's your impression as you're listening to Henry Morales talk about this book of his and his life?
In a really interesting way, I actually feel like I can actually connect to him. Not by the fact that I grew up the same life that he had, but the way he speaks, it has like a almost like this desire to be accepted by a community, and the level of wanting to be accepted is what differentiates both of us. But I could hear it in his voice that he's speaking out almost to what I want for myself, which is to always be accepted. And when you lack that, you got to look at it. You got to look for other paths to find that.
212-757-4488, 212-757-4488. $200 donation. You get the one-time consultation with me personally. You can have a one-time consultation with Henry Morales as well, I'm sure, or Julian Joyello or Alexander Rivas, either one of us. But I think if you want to meet with me one time, it's probably a good idea. You know, if you've got stuff that's leaning on you, this is a good time to meet it. And if you could listen to me interviewing Henry here, Rico, as he was called in the streets, you could understand the nature of the way I would be talking to you probably, although I wouldn't be putting it on air. Henry has generously given of his time and exposed himself to us, to the world, as the person he is. I mean, here's what Henry says about himself. He says, I am a killer. I am a thief. I've spent most of my life in jail. He says, I somehow didn't belong in society. I'm looking to become part of it by giving as much as I can. And he wrote this exquisite short tome called The Journey of a Man by Henry Morales. 212-757-4488. Go to your phones right now, my friends. 212-757-4488. We're going to continue. We're going to be playing a little music for you right now. It's a good chance for you to go to your phones. 212-757-4488. We'll put this together for you so that you can continue on with your own journey. 212-757-4488. Make a donation to the station. You can do it by MasterCard or Visa or American Express. Any way you want, just give us a call. 212-757-4488. $200 donation gets you a one-time meeting with me. Or for a $75 donation, we will send you the copy of Journey of a Man by Henry Morales. So you could just make a straight donation, $100, $50, any amount you want. Just give us a call, 212-757-4488, any amount of money to help this station keep going and the stuff that we're doing with you. 212-757-4488. Here's a little sweet music for your ears. And when we come back, we'll come back with our interview, continue with our interview with Henry Morales. 212-757-4488. We'll be back with you in just a few minutes, my friend. Go to your phones. Make your calls. 212-757-4488.
Beer and whiskey and beer. Makes your head start aching. Makes your eyes unclear. Makes you waste your money. Turns you blind and dumb.
Give me some.
Strong tobacco, cigarette smoke.
Fills your lungs with poison, makes your brain go numb.
Give me some.
Hey, come back here. Will you ever get smart?
I doubt it. Tell me something's bad and I can't live without it.
Pretty women, blue-eyed or brown, how they drive you crazy, how they drag you down. Soon they're fat and happy, you're a worn-out bum. Give me some, give me some. Will I ever get smart? I doubt it. Tell me something's bad and I can't live without it.
Say I'm foolish, tell me I'm strange. Sure, but I'm still having too much fun to change.
Guess you'll go on saying till your time has come.
Give me some.
Give me some. Give me some. You're too old to smoke. Give me that cigarette.
This is Armand DeMille back with you with The Positive Mind. We're interviewing Henry Morales and his book, Journey of a Man. We've all had our trials and tribulations. We've all had the paths we've had to cross. We've all had tough places in our lives that we've had to, where we've been challenged. Henry and his book kind of gives us an idea of how some people survive challenges. And I hope you do as well. 212-757-4488. 212-757-4488. You can still make your calls. We're going to go back with our interview right now. So as that goes on and you get to the point where you start, where does the violence come in? Where does...
Well, once I got to a... well, aside from being physically abused in the convent, at 12 years old, when I came to St. Vincent's Home for Boys, that's when other boys used to beat me, and the counselors, my last time before I ran away in from St. Vincent's was the director, his name was Kelly, we had, myself and two of the other boys, we had stolen some money out of a counselor's pocketbook. And he called us downstairs, and he called me down first because he, for somehow, he just knew that I was involved, and he just beat me mercilessly, and I kept telling him I didn't have it. And there was two or three other counselors there, and he beat me so bad that the other counselor said, maybe he doesn't have it. You know, take it easy. You know, maybe he doesn't have it. And he sent me back upstairs, and he brought the other boy down and beat them a little bit, and they confessed to having the money. And they told Mr. Kelly that if we tell you who the other person is, you have to promise not to hit them and, you know, or punish them. He said, okay, who was the other person? They woke me back up in the middle of the night and brought me back downstairs and asked for the money. And I could see that the other two guys were there. So I just said, okay. So I reached in my underwear, where I had the money, and just gave it to them. And they were just looking at each other. They didn't believe I could take the whipping that they gave me and that I was still hold on to the money.
You remember that whipping?
Oh, yeah, I remember it very well.
And there was a part of you that has that as a power. There's a part of you that said, I'm not going to tell them. I'm not. I mean, you were convinced you weren't going to tell them. They could strike. They could draw blood, which they probably did anyway, right?
It didn't matter what they
did. What was the punishment with? Belts?
Belts, yeah. Belts and hands and fists, you know.
And how old were you?
12.
12. Mm-hmm. Yeah, now you're old to get the real punishment, right? Mm-hmm. So now 12 years old. So
what happened is I ran away. And I had run away a couple other times, but this time I'd stayed a day or so out. Out of St. Vincent's, and he sent word out through a couple of the other kids. There was three of us who ran away together, and it was a Friday. He told the other two guys they have to be back by Sunday, and you tell Morales to keep running. You know, and you know, we laughed and joked and everything about that. You know, but in my own head, I was thinking, "Wow, what am I going to do?" You know, but I never went back, so I stayed in the streets after that. And so that my living in the streets, my trying to survive by snatching pocketbooks and going in stores, and when registers would open, I would grab money and run.
When did you get a gun? When was your first gun?
I was almost 14.
Uh-huh.
And one of the guys from the convent went to his house, and I think he told me it was his uncle's gun or someone, but he brought it out one evening. And I had been living in the streets already for a number of months already, and you know, trying to survive. And he showed me the gun, and he said, "Oh yeah, I gotta get it back to my uncle before he realizes." I said, "No, let's use it. Let's make some money." And so we wind up robbing a liquor store downtown Brooklyn, and we got $800 out of it.
Wow, a lot of money.
I was rich.
Yeah.
You know, I was. And,
how did you hold it up? I mean, did you actually hold a loaded gun? You walked in with a loaded gun?
They were scared to hold the gun.
Right.
So I said, let me hold it. And, you know, and I mean, I was scared too. But I still, this is survival now. So I just pulled it out and I held it to the man's head and I told him to open up the register and why I took the money out. And it became my pattern. From that moment on, that I would always be the one to control the situation by holding the gun on the man, and whoever my partner was would always go get the money.
Do you have any question about the fact that you would have fired that gun or not? I mean, if the guy made trouble for you, if the guy reached down for a bat or something, you would have shot him.
I don't think either way. I probably would have.
Yeah,
because in the future, that's what I did. You know. So in that situation,
in the future, when it came time to use the gun, you did. Yeah, when you came to firing or killing somebody, that was all piece of it.
It was all part of it. But I was always, not always, up until maybe 15, 16, I would do whatever I had to do. Sometime around 17, I was kind of conscious of, don't shoot if you don't have to. You know, because I was always thinking, wow, if you shoot and you get busted, there's going to be, the case is going to be much more serious. So I could see myself starting to understand how the system worked, the prison system, even though I hadn't really been a part of it yet.
So what you were mainly doing is manipulating the system for the punishment. It wasn't any developed sense of, I don't want to kill that guy.
Oh,
he's got a family.
No.
Hell with that.
Oh, no. I never even...
He's got what I deserve. He's got the money I'm supposed to have.
That's just the situation that he's in, you know, I'm in. And
he's in your way.
That's it. That's it.
He's in the way between you and the money you want.
That's it.
Now, how much of this is drug-induced? I mean, I'm not drug-induced, but are you doing heavy drugs at this point?
Well, not heavy drugs. I was doing a lot of heroin.
Not heavy drugs. You were doing the light stuff, the heroin. I'm sorry.
This is the 60s.
Henry, you mean no serious drugs like marijuana. He was doing...
We're doing marijuana, you know, and pills and Tubinols, Secanols, and that sort of stuff. But it seems like everyone was doing heroin.
Mostly snorting heroin.
Yes, mostly snorting it, you know. But I was already shooting. I was already mainlining. I had started doing that before I was 16. Actually, when I was 16, I started mainlining. But before that, I was skin popping and sniffing, you know. But everyone was doing it. And when I say everyone, I just all the stick-up kids and the people who were making money in the streets and going to little clubs like COCP, Bill Daly's. Yeah, these are little clubs downtown Brooklyn. And everyone was sniffing heroin, you know. So,
what's it like to shoot heroin? What's the first feeling of that substance entering your body at the end of a syringe?
It's like a numbing bliss.
Beautiful.
Well, everything gets shut off. All pain, all misery, everything just dissipates.
Yeah.
That's what it is. You know. And one aspect of heroin that I never appreciated was it usually made me throw up. You know, but once you got past that part there, it's
nothing else. I mean, we had a kid who came in here once who was a heavy crack user, and he said to me, my mother's a hooker, my supposed father's a pimp. He said, and when I go out in the streets, I steal all day long. I smoke crack, he says, and for a minute, it all disappears.
It's that bliss.
And he said to me, is there anything you could give me that would take place of that? I had nothing to give him. It's that bliss. It's that freedom. It's that feeling of, I wish people could understand, that heroin feels like heaven. You know, heroin feels like home. It's like a home you never had. There it is. Mm-hmm. Whew, there's that feeling. Even snorting it will do that. It'll even take it in through the nose. You know,
you can overdose by snorting it.
As well.
Yes, as well. Yeah.
And so this is a kind of a paradisial remove for a moment. Then after that, something happens. After that, your mind is moving in a pattern that doesn't seem to have... I mean, why are you necessarily, if you could get to home, what happens that brings you back to a point where you're going to have to stick up a liquor store and get money? Is it to get the money for the drugs?
Well, I'm putting myself back in time, and there's nothing else in the world for me. I mean, I have nowhere to go. I have nowhere to live. How do I exist? What's the purpose of life? So for me, I'm living day for day, and my pleasure is doing a stick up, getting high, partying, you know, and then doing the whole thing over again, you know, going to bed, waking back up, and let's do it again until the end comes, whatever the end is. And I noticed when I started doing a lot of armed robberies, my mentality was, I'll go as long as I can, you know, as far as I can doing this over and over and over again. And as long as I'm willing to accept the consequences, and to me the consequences were either death or life in prison. And I said, oh, I can accept either one of those. And that made it easy for me just to go forward. You know, so I just went forward. You know, prison was no more than being in homes. You know,
prison you've dealt with. You've been to homes. You've been to
institutions. It's the same thing. It's the same thing. Prisons, there's no difference. You know,
whatever happens there, and death is death.
Death is death.
Death may be actually more appealing.
And by this time, there's a number of people who had been, you know, had overdosed, who had been shot in robberies, you know, by the police or by store managers. You know, a number of things had happened already. So death wasn't any big deal. You know, it's just
so life is not a big deal. You see, it's not that death is a big deal. Life is not a big deal. life is party. Use up your money. You know, you're not thinking about retirement plans. You're not thinking about that. You're not putting it in a 401k or whatever they call those things. You're just thinking to yourself, all right, put a little away, get some girls, get some drugs, get some alcohol, get some, and party as much as you can, and then we'll start back tomorrow. Yeah. Now, are you one of the guys who are showing off when you're flush, when you have money? Are you looking real sharp? Are you?
I'm looking very, 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 very sharp. You know, I have a picture of me. I can show you my phone now. When I'm 16 years old, I look like I'm 40.
Really?
Yeah, I'm dressed like a James Cagney picture with a
kind of a hat,
a beaver hat, you know, yeah. A Fletcher. Those hats they call long-haired beavers. Uh-huh. You know, and I have a silk coat on and a full-length silk coat, you know, silk shirts and alligator shoes and that sort of stuff. You know, so you know, every day was like that. I'd go into a store and buy four or five pair of shoes. You know.
And you had loads of cash.
Different colors, yeah.
Loads of cash.
Yeah.
Were you also
But it's not really a lot of, I mean, now it's not no money at all, you know, but.
Were you dealing drugs at the same time? Were you?
Well, that came later, when I got into my 20s.
When you got into your 20s. But mainly at this time, you're using and you're stealing.
Just using and stealing.
First man you ever killed?
You know, when you get into this life, first of all, let me back up a little bit. When I used to, when I was growing up, I always watched James Cagney, you know, Humphrey Bogart, you know, these were like my heroes, you know, Edward G. Robinson, you know, and they played these hard gangsters, you know, and that's how I thought an adult was supposed to be, mm-hmm. and I had very little real respect for life. Not an excuse, but just how I was living at the time. And I became aware that when you live this lifestyle, anything goes with other people who are living the same lifestyle. And then that other people are just civilians. So you have one set of rules for these people, and the rest of the other people just really don't count. So with that in mind, the first person that I actually know that I removed was a number of a guy who did numbers. He was an Italian guy, and it was four of us, and we went to hit a number joint, and as we were going into the place, he was coming out. So we left one guy behind the wheel, and the three of us were crossing the street. As he was coming out, I told the two other guys, go right inside the place. I'm going to make him go back in. And so they went right into the place, and I went right up to the guy, and I put my gun in his stomach. I said, back up in there. And he looked down at me, looked at me like I was some kind of young punk or something, and started laughing, turned around, and started to walk away. And I just lit up into him, you know. And my partners came running out of the store thinking there was a shootout going on with their guns out ready to shoot. I said, no, come on, let's go. And the guy dropped his bag of money, and the money started to fly. And they went to grab the money. I said, no. If he wants to die for his money, let him keep it. And then we got back in the car and we took off. And as soon as we took off, the police showed up. Mm-hmm. Had we stopped to pick up that money, we all would have been in jail. You know, so, you know. Mm-hmm. But also when that happened, I remember being conscious to myself saying, where did that come from? That actual statement. You know, if he wants to die for his money, let him keep it.
Where did that come from? And you just killed the guy.
I know.
But, and what did that?
But something inside of me said that I finally crossed
the line.
The line. You know, there's no going back now. Now I know I'm a grown man, and I know that I'm
a tough guy.
Yeah,
absolutely.
And from that point on, I, you know, I had maybe a good 20 years of, you know, crime and hard crime and. You know, it just led to a bunch of other stuff where I wouldn't hesitate to do anything.
This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind. We're here today to ask you to help us, support us with our efforts to try to keep this station alive. 212-757-4488. We're making you a special offering today. This remarkable thing you're listening to, this book by Henry Morales, is a very interesting story if you think about it. You think about the fact that here's a man who's locked up in Elmira prison, who's listening to WBAI, is now here being interviewed trying to tell you about the life that led him to being locked up in Elmira and the life of the mind of a man with this kind of a life. I mean, what a precious thing. What a perfect circle it is to hear it go around in such a way. This is not to condone any of the behaviors that Henry Morales had as a child, because there were many of us who had a great deal of problems, killing, stealing, robbing, working outside the system. They're not right. They're wrong. I mean, it's not the way to get through. However, learning about it, hearing about it, is really remarkable. 212-757-4488. For a $75 donation, you'll get a copy of his book, The Journey of a Man, by Henry Morales, and it'll be signed by Henry as well. He'll sit here and he'll sign each and every book and we'll mail it out to you. It's a remarkable thing. The story has touched me. I mean, I've read this in my spare time, a few pages at a time. It's written very, very, very well. 212-757-4488. For a $200 donation, my friends, you may be familiar with this, we're offering that one-time consultation once again. And this is because I'm going to make the time available over the summer. We'll be able to do a one-time meeting with me. Now, here's what happens in the one-time meeting. You send me, you call our office, you make a donation to the station, 212-757-4488. The station gets the money immediately. We transfer it over to them right away. Then Jamie Ross, my manager, will call you and she'll give you an appointment. She'll tell you a time that's available, which will be within a few weeks. Within a few weeks. And the appointment itself has a lot of different pieces to it, many interesting good pieces. One is you will send me an email before we meet, and I will look at the email, which will have in it your history and some of the issues that you want to deal with. So I'll have a little advanced information. Then you come in my office. You fill out a couple of questionnaires that tell me a little more about your background, understanding about your thinking style. We put that all together, and then you meet with me face-to-face. And I'll give you my feedback from what I see, but also the most important feedback is from what you tell me and how I respond. 212-757-4488. It's a valuable thing. I've seen hundreds of people, thousands of people by now, and they all seem to walk away satisfied.
This is Jamie Ross. What I really enjoy about the work I do with Armand is the difference it makes. And what we do with the Positive Mind through the Internet is touch the hearts and minds of people around the world. They are introduced to a different way of being, a way of understanding and a way of knowing, a way of loving. By your supporting the Positive Mind, you make a difference. Please call now at 212-757-4488 and make a donation. Support the station. Give heart to the listeners around the globe who are all part of the family. 212-757-4488. That's 212-757-4488. For a $200 donation, you get a consultation with Armand Demel. That's 212-757-4488. This is Jamie Ross.
212-757-4488. Journey of a Man, $75 donation. Henry Morales. If you don't want the book, you don't want to come and see me, or if you've done that already this year, $200 donation, come and see me. 212-757-4488. Journey of a Man, $75 donation. MasterCard, Visa, American Express, any of those. We need you to go to your phones right now, my friends. 212-757-4488. 212-757-4488. Let me give you a little music here. And while you're listening to the music, use this as an opportunity to bop over to your phone and make a call. 212-757-4488. 212-757-4488. I will be on air just, I think, maybe two times during this fund drive. I'm not sure exactly when. But I know today we've got the 2 hours and the representation of Henry Morales and Journey of a Man. And then I will be back with you next. I'm not exactly sure. We'll let you know. You could go to my website, thepositivemind.com, or to my Facebook page, either one, and we'll try to post the schedule of when we'll be doing this next. 212-757-4488. We'll be back with you in a couple of minutes.
stick around, things are gonna happen. Fireworks, stick around and see. Watch me in the arena eat Cracker Jack while I'm smacking some hack for a fee. Stick around, you can hold the basket while I shake that money tree. And of course, in certain cases, a dark horse may win some races. Stick around, lady, and see. Stick around and you'll see some action. Who can tell what the kid will do? Here I go after diamonds and I'll come back with a sack full and toss you a few. Stick around, you can shine my trophies. Lead the cheers when they shout for me. There won't be nobody hotter. I want the whole enchilada. And if I come up winner, Brotherhood Week, take me to dinner. Stick around, lady, and see the boy who's gone to bite. See that boy start moving right. Stick around, lady, and see.
You know, if you walk through the clouds with your head held high, you never have to pitch alone. You'll never pitch alone. Isn't that the way the song goes? Well, I'm not sure. You'll never pitch alone. Pitching alone is quite an interesting thing. Luckily, I don't have to pitch alone because there are generations following me. We've had the help of Alexander Rivas and with the help of my partner here in crime, Julian Joiello. Julian is no ordinary guy. He and I have worked together at being able to bring to you the last 6 months' programs. And it's taken quite a bit of science and strategy and planning and timing and effort. And Julian, I really appreciate you for what you do for me and especially for WBAI. You've made a major contribution.
Thank you. I love being a part of this. It's an amazing experience. And we're here. And we're doing the pitching, and you guys know how it is. It's $200 donation for the consultation with Armand, the one-time consultation, which is just as good and getting better as it's always been. And then this $75 donation for this book. I'm listening to this interview, and my mind is being boggled. It's a story of intensity and growing and change and all of this happening, and it's such an interesting story that I'm so glad that I'm here to be able to hear this all happening and witness this on air. And to get this book signed by Henry Morales, $75 contribution to WBAI, call now 212-757-4488. And this is a worthwhile contribution, this book, which I've just gotten a copy myself. I'm very excited to read, and you should be too. $75 contribution, 212-757-4488. And as always, you can also call that number for the $200 consultation with Armand DeMille. It's 212-757-4488.
212-757-4488. The book starts, orphaned at six, I left my home carrying sneakers and a gun, indicating how I would walk the furious journey that awaited me. Without conscience, without guilt, I raised myself and my fury in the streets and institutions of America. To me, it was exciting. To America, it was deadly. I write this not to complain, but simply to show what occurred as I tried to find some kind of meaning and understanding in my life. It's also an apology and a more complete picture for those who may have been impacted by my actions. Henry Morales talks about causing the death of some of the people he had to face off. 212-757-4488. A hard read, but it's not a hard read. It's not one of these things that you feel like, oh, my God, I can't read this. No, 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 no. It's very readable, and it doesn't glorify the street life. It talks about what the street life is. 212-757-4488, my friends. A consultation, a one-time consultation with me. Why? Because while I'm still around here, before I retire, before I get out of here and decide to spend my life at the beach, which is always very tempting, I love meeting the new people at WBAI and some of you guys, and love being able to help you. The $200 consultation fee is a great discount. People call me wanting to make appointments with me or search my consultation. I kind of get fees like a lawyer gets, you know. It's like I've been around a while, I have good experience. So usually it's a much higher fee. But for this $200 donation, you can get to meet with me one time. It's a very good thing, and I give you the best I've got. I don't hold back anything. I give you everything I could possibly give you that helps you get to the step where you can see exactly what you need at this time. Sometimes you can't, and you can't find what you need, and you come to me, and I wind up giving you a direction. Sometimes I tell you you need no direction. You're on the path. Sometimes I just meet with people just to say hello. 212-757-4488. Make your calls right now. 212-757-4488. $200. Sounds like a lot of money, but you've probably done it already this year. $200, you get the one-time meeting with me. You get a consultation with me. Now, if you've already taken advantage of that, and you think to yourself, oh, maybe I could get to see him a second time for the same fee. We've usually said, no, you can't do that because it's a one-time consultation fee. It's like it's a thing we do once.
It's a one-timer.
It's a one-timer. But, you know, I think not. I think in this case, if you've only seen me once and you wanted to see me a second time with some kind of feedback, but you couldn't afford it, I will honor that, but do that only if you really need to do it, my friends. 212-757-4488. You can come in with your family. Many people come in with their children. Come in with your children, your daughters, your sons, your mothers, your fathers, your husband, your wife, your significant other. Bring your second cousin, your second cousin. You got troubles with your second cousin. You clarify that here because you're going to produce better radio if you do it that way.
It is.
Don't you think?
I believe I am a second cousin.
You're my second cousin. If you don't know, my friend, you may be able to tell by our voices since they're so similar.
Very, very similar.
I'm going to start imitating you. If you did an imitation of me, go ahead. Let's see you do it. This is an Armand. Do the opening. Go ahead. Maybe I'll put the music behind you. Maybe I'll be the music. Da-da-da. No. Go ahead. Okay, see, here it comes. Julian imitating his second cousin doing the introduction to the Positive Mind.
This is Armand DeMille with the Positive Mind. Tuesdays and Wednesdays at 1 p.m.
Like James Mason. That was James Mason.
How am I supposed to do that?
Well, how is that James Mason? I can do it, Julian.
James Mason. All right.
But I'm not
going
to do it.
You're not going to, though, because I don't have a radio show, so.
No, but you have a voice. You have a very distinct voice. You have a very distinct,
that's why.
Beautiful
that's,
voice.
It's unique.
I love your voice.
Thank you.
Let me see where your voice comes from. Well, thank you very much. Yes. Yes. This is Julian Joiello here with you at the Positive Mind here on WBAI. If you make a $200 donation to do I sound like you? A little higher register.
A little
well,
gravel.
You see, but you have, yeah, I know, right.
Gathered.
Yeah, you haven't swallowed enough gravel.
I haven't
in
swallowed
your
enough
life.
Gravel, only a little bit.
Yeah, it takes years to swallow the proper amount of gravel to get this voice.
I've only got like, you know, maybe a small cup of gravel gathered in my throat right now. And I've got years to go with that.
Years of graveling
years
to
of
go.
Gravel.
Okay. Graveling comes with groveling. You know, you grovel, you eventually get the gravel, then you get the right to be
Segways.
On the radio, and you ask people for 212-757-4488. Make a donation to the station, my friends. Make a donation to the future of Julian Joiello, 20-year-old wise ass. 212-75.
Is that what they're donating for now?
No.
Not at all.
Two 212-757-4488. 212-757-4488. This is Armand DeMille back with you with The Positive Mind. We're interviewing Henry Morales and his book, Journey of a Man. Okay, so we're getting back to a question that was asked about the feeling of it is like it's an automatic. Now, I know I've got a 10 years before you, and in our life, the image of a man was the military guy, the soldier. And so, therefore, we were very attracted to gang life. And the gangs were like soldiers. And we felt like it was territorial. And it was like we were on Iwo Jima and we were fighting each other. And the gangs were about armies. Then after that came in your crew with the Edward G. Robinson kind of, and this idea of what a man is. So our man was a gang, you know? And it was like, that was one illusion. Now, your man is this independent guy, the individual who's so tough that...
Who accepts every and anything that comes his way.
You could eat anything.
It doesn't matter what it was.
Okay, now, just curiously, Henry, was there ever a romance in there anywhere?
You know, in those early years... Not a real romance. I had so many women, I mean, a lot of women older than me, much older, and girls my age also, who were just available to me. And without me having to put forth much effort.
And it was at a time when it was very available and easily available, too.
Right,
it was
the 60s and 70s, yes.
So sex was very available.
Everywhere.
And everybody was attracted to you because you're strong and you have power.
And I'm hustling, and people know I'm a good hustler. So when someone knows you're a good hustler, you know, they know there's money there all the time. So they can, if they come and party with you, if they hang around you, they know they could be taken care of.
And what about romance? What about, do you ever meet anybody you say, this person I like more than anybody else? Were they all dispensable?
Basically all dispensable. I mean, I had one or two girlfriends, but I never had one or two girlfriends alone. You know, I had someone who might consider themselves a girlfriend. But I had
you
ton
mean
other
the main
women
lady
also.
And you got backups everywhere.
Right. Right.
Right? And if so, the main one leaves, you kind of say, well, that's kind of gone. We'll move on to the next.
Right. Right.
Okay.
And I think all that was because of my search for love. I need affection. I need... Yeah, I was missing it all my life, and so I needed
it. I don't even know if love is the word, but there's a feeling you're searching for your whole life, which is a feeling of belonging, of connecting to something. And since you're convinced that it's not available, death may be the only way to go there. You know, death is not such a bad...
This is the... there's been a couple of times that you've said something that's stayed with me.
Over the years or just
no
today?
Just you in our first meeting when you said that one of the reasons that me and my son are not as close as we should be is because I'm always telling him what to do, how to do it, what's and I thought about it and I said, whoa, that rings kind of true. I'm always telling him, no, don't do it this way, this is better, this is how you take care of yourself, this is, and I said, just let him be, so that's something that stayed with me. But it was something else, and it just slipped my mind just now. But it's seeing someone else's insight,
Sure.
To my own life, or things that I've done.
Did they always call you Henry, by the way, or did you have
nicknames? Actually, my street name was Enrico.
Enrico.
Rico, yeah.
Rico, R-I-C-O.
R-I-C-O, yeah. So,
wow, just as Enrico.
Right, and it's like Enrique is the Spanish version of my name. Mm-hmm. And I'm Puerto Rican also, but... So Rico comes from that.
So you were known as Rico in the streets.
Right.
At some point, God forbid somebody should ever have profiled you and decided to come after you. They wouldn't have walked away.
They wouldn't have.
wouldn't have walked away easily, and it's no
joke. But it's different than Trayvon and that sort of thing. I always thought, and this just being the individual man that I was and that I still am today, but... I always felt responsible for every and anything that happened to me. I've been shot twice, and I don't blame other people. That's my fault. I've been hit by a car a couple of times. It's my fault. Everything and anything that happens to me, it's my fault. I should be aware of every and anything that's going to happen to me. This is just what I put on myself.
But do you put it on
and
yourself
I really believe
as
it.
A guilt, a shame, or just a...
This is how life is. You should
this
be aware
sequence,
of every and
right.
anything that happens to you in this life. You draw it to you. You bring it upon yourself. Something about you is bringing that to you.
So if it's happening to you, you're bringing it to yourself.
Yes. And this is just the code that I have in my own life. I don't expect other people to go by it or, how they live their lives, or how they judge themselves, or how they see themselves. This is how I see myself.
But what about when people want to present themselves as victims to you and they tell you, oh, it's...
Well, that's just the stage of development that they're in. You're only a victim emotionally. Like, when I have conversations with people, I say, the earth opens up and swallows up 100,000 people, and it makes no apology. It just goes on. Mm-hmm. See? And that's only bad because you're looking at it and making a judgment on it. But the earth doesn't care nothing about it. It's going on. And so that's how I see life. Every and anything that happens to me, it's...
So you got
just
no
the
one
way
to blame.
It is.
You have no one to blame.
No,
there is no.
That is life unfolding.
Just to guns for a moment, because guns are such an interesting thing in the streets. Most of the kids carry guns nowadays.
I don't know that. But
do you know that? Or don't you know that?
I don't think most kids carry guns.
You don't think they do?
No.
You don't think that most of the kids who have a similar kind
of
background.
I think people have access. People have access to guns, but most of them don't carry it. In the street, there's a small group of guys. Like the way I saw myself, I'm mostly out of the Fort Greene area, Fort Greene projects, And what I see there is there's a group of kids who kids are very aware, and I was very aware as I was coming up, someone once explained to me about capitalism, hard work. A certain group of people always have to be out of work in order for capitalism to work. And so when I was, I was 15 when I made this decision. I said, so if a certain group always has to be out of work, let me make it easy for somebody else. I won't even look. I won't even involve myself in that area. And I'll make my money in the streets. Mm-hmm. You see, and then there's young kids who make that choice because they had nothing else offered to them.
Right. So you know, they're going to lose anyway.
They're going to lose anyway. And so they make their own life in the street. That's how you get your underground, economy, you know, and it's called hustling, you know. And then these people make this decision because they know that the whole structure is all against them anyway. You see, and everyone who's in power is more or less abusing and using everybody else. And these other people are just like the suckers, you know, the people who go along with the program that's been put down by the higher-ups, and they fall into place. And these young guys who can see this and see no way of and choose not to struggle in that area because they know it's to no avail. So they just drop out, and they hustle in the street, and they accept what happens to them and how they live. And that's not to say there's not misery in that life. There's not misery in that choice. There's not second-guessing that choice.
But there's no one to blame.
There's no one to blame, yeah.
You just weren't sharp enough. That's it. You just missed that. You didn't see that one coming. It's your fault.
Basically.
Yeah. You know, at the beginning of your book, you make apologies.
Yes. I it's to humanity. I was 50 years old before I decided to join the human race.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, as a...
You never thought you were going to live to 50, right?
I didn't know I was going to live to 21. I didn't know I was going to make 18.
You would have flossed your teeth if you did, right?
When I woke up when I was 21, and I said, wow, I'm still alive.
Amazing thing.
It was amazing, you know. And then when I made it into my 30s, I said, oh, Lord, what am I going to do now, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I had to figure out what I'm going to do the rest of my life, you know. But actually, I was 38 when I was in Leavenworth, being released from about 12 years of misery there, you know.
Was that the time you were on your knees wishing that you would not come back?
Yes.
Tell that story about that moment before you leaving.
Well, I was going to see the parole board, and I had realized that the way I had been living wasn't... wasn't doing me any good. It was time for me to change, and I wanted to change. And it had nothing to do with the overall opinion of right and wrong, or good and bad, and that sort of thing. It had to do with me as an individual. And I did not want to spend the rest of my life in jail. And I had to make that decision. And I recalled this many years ago when I first was in Elmira, and an older gentleman saying, you know, you guys are going to keep coming back. He was talking to a group of us. You guys are going to keep coming back to jail until you get scared of it. And, you know, I had forgotten that statement, but I recalled it at that time when I was ready to see the parole board in Leavenworth. And I was telling myself, I don't want to come back. I don't want to be ruled by small-minded people, which is what happens with prison guards. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to be caged in like this. In Leavenworth, you had 1,100 inmates, 800 who were never getting out. Ever. And when I first went to Leavenworth, you know, there was maybe a stabbing every day, you know, maybe a murder every 2 weeks or so, you know. And I was saying, no, I'm finished with this. You know, I just did not want to spend the rest of my life in jail. And so I just got on my knees and I asked the universe to take this gangster spirit away from me, take it out of me, and give me a chance to live. I want to live, and so that's what happened, you know.
And then you got paroled, and you decided. You said, "Okay, so now I'm not going to get a gun. I'm not going to hold up a store. I'm going to try to get a job."
Yeah, actually, I had a good friend of mine who's also a friend of BAI, a guy by the name of Jamal Joseph. And actually, I was going to parole out to California. But he convinced me to parole to
New York,
and then he looked out for me when I came home. But actually, from having worked in the prison Unicor, which is a Fortune 500 company inside prison, you know, which is what all prisons are becoming anyway.
They made uniforms.
I was sewing uniforms for the military.
Right.
You know, so I'm a very good sewer. You know, they also make the wire rings for the spaceships that mm-hmm. travel in space. They make glasses, they make furniture, everything. It's a Fortune 500 company, and it's from prison. It's all prison labor, you know. So I had saved up about $6,000 or so. And so this is the first time I'm leaving prison with money. Very little, you know, $6,000, that's not anything, but it was enough to keep the edge off while I finagled the job. And since I had spent a lot of time cooking also in a lot of prisons, I came home and I put an application into, I think it was TGI Fridays, and where you put the your job references. And I said I had been working for the federal system as a chef, not saying that I was prison. You know, and that's how I got hired. You know?
They didn't check that.
They didn't
one.
Check it. You know,
all right.
and if you work in the federal system, I don't know how they may have checked. You, if you're working in Unicor, you actually are contributing to your Social Security. You see, so it actually comes up as having been a job.
Oh, good. Okay.
Yeah, you know.
So now you got a job, and now you're convinced that you want to give up to James Cagney, and you're saying, that's
yes.
it, I'm kind of done with this. It's like it possessed my mind for 50 years. They owned me. This was the father I took that I didn't have. And I became this creature. I became this guy. And this guy had no conscience. This guy had no will of his own. No, he was just run. And then all of a sudden, at 50 years old, I decide I'm going to be different. And I just don't want to be run by...
I want to join the human race. That's all it was.
Thank you.
Not with the pressure of running and having to commit crime and that sort of thing. You know, I realized there's crime all around me. I mean, the government is nothing but crime. It's a crime syndicate. And nothing has changed between, you know... I mean, today it's exactly the same thing. If you look around you, if you study government, you see it's just a crime syndicate. You know, so... But I wasn't going to let that be the reason why I would do crime. And I know within myself there was always a good person. I don't know if that makes sense to you, but I've always known that there was something good about me.
But how? How do you know that? Did you suddenly, when one of your buddies fell down and when you were running away from the police?
Here's what I would do. Here's the things that made me aware of that. When I would do... My armed robberies, I would make whoever was with me, don't shoot anybody. You know, that was always my thing. You know, that's just for showing off. Don't do that. If you're in a situation and that needs to be done, then it's different. But just to show off is, you know, don't do it. You know, and I was very, very adhered to that. You know, My own individual morals seem to be, from my point of view, higher than the rest of the society around me. You know, I mean, there's people starving everywhere. People, you know, just so much going on. People don't have places to live, places to eat. You know, and I wouldn't do that to individuals. I wouldn't do that to somebody. You know, you call yourself being a just society. I wouldn't go around killing, you know, FALN members and Panthers and I mean, death penalty. I mean, there's so many things that are wrong with this society, you know. And so their morals, they're in no standing to judge me. And so I my own individual code of honor was higher than that of the society around me. And it seemed like that all my life.
Mm-hmm.
In spite of what I was doing.
Right. In spite of what you're doing, you're looking around you and you're saying...
I'm seeing what's going on.
We'll be back with you in just a few minutes, my friend. Here's a little music. And when we come back, we'll continue with our interview with Henry Morales. 212-757-4488. Friend, go to your phones, make your calls. 212-757-4488.
I once knew a nigga whose real name was William. His primary concern was making a million, being the illest hustler that the world ever seen. He used to off movie stars and sniff coke in his dreams. A corrupted young mind at the age of 13. And he never had a father and his mom was a fiend. She put the pipe down, but for every year she was sober. Her son's heart simultaneously grew colder. He started hanging out, selling bags in the projects, checking the young chicks, looking for hit and run prospects. He was fascinated by material objects, but he understood money never bought respect. He
built a reputation, cause he could hustle and steal, but got locked once and didn't hesitate to squeal. So criminals he chilled with didn't think he was real. You see, me and niggas like this have never been equal. I don't project my insecurities on other people. He fiended for props like addicts with pipes and needles, and so he felt he had to prove to everyone he was evil. A feeble-minded young man with infinite potential, the product of a ghetto-bred capitalistic mental, dancing with the devil smoke until his eyes would bleed. But he was sick of selling trees and gave in to his greed. Everyone trying to be trife, never face the consequences. You probably only did a month for minor offenses, asking a nigga in life if he had another chance. But then again, there's always the wicked that knew in advance. Dance forever with the devil on a cold cell block, but that's what happens when you rape, murder, and sell rock. Devils used to be gods, angels that fell from the top. There's no diversity because we're burning in the melting pot.
212-757-4488.
212-757-4488.
Go to your phones right now, my friends. This is maybe our last chance to be able to get you in right now. We're going to be back with you in a couple next week or a couple of weeks from now for another two-hour special. But right now, what we're bringing you is this offering. For a $200 donation, you get a one-time meeting with me, Armand DeMille. We have the people standing by right now. And for a $200 donation... No, that's a $200 donation. For the $75 donation, you get a copy of the book by Henry Morales, and you don't need to get anything. You can give us a $50 donation, a $100 donation, a $500 donation. Support us, support the station, support the Positive Mind, which is heard all over the world now. I mean, I get letters from different countries and different cities in Canada and Mexico and... I get people writing in saying, you know, this is really significant and important to them. So you're the ones who make that happen by your donation, by us keeping the station, by us keeping the radio antenna, which we're fighting real hard. 212-757-4488. You know, Julian, in the old days, there would be enough funding that would come from different places that would support the kind of public radios there. But we don't have that anymore. Now it's all up to the people who listen. And everybody who listens knows. I was listening at 7 o'clock this morning to Esther Armand. What a program she had. What a thing. I mean, her perception and the guest's perception about, you know, if you're wearing a T-shirt and you're a white middle-class person wearing a T-shirt that says Trevor Martin on it, you know, and it shows the young boy and his wasted life. She said, what you should be wearing is a George Zimmerman face. Because if you're wearing that face, then you're saying, this is me. This is who I really am. Because I'm a part of this society. You know, whoosh, what potent stuff to hear on the radio. 212-757-4488. Right from 6 o'clock in the morning, you turn that radio on.
The second you wake up. You've got these ideas coming into your life.
I better not say that about you, because if I did, the second you wake up, you'd always hear the Positive Mind. He stays up late. You know, he's one of these guys.
Second I go to sleep, Esther Amazon.
Right. Okay, so we're getting back to a question that was asked about. So at some point, you're 50 years old, you get out, you get a job, you start getting, I remember you said something about you put $50, you got your first credit card. Right? It was a big deal.
It was a big deal.
Sure. Sure, credit card, a telephone number, all of those things that are really important. And something shifted. Now, something made that succeed.
I went to this, I got married. I got married twice. I got married and divorced. The first time was just about a year or so. But everything has its purpose. And if you want to hear a great story, it's I married Claudia Sampson, and she was working for Marsha McLennan. And they transferred her to Puerto Rico to get the office down there straightened out. And she asked me if I wanted to make the trip with her, and I checked it out for a week or so, and I said, oh, yeah, I like PR, you know, and I'm Puerto Rican anyway. Maybe I can find my father's family. I put an ad in the paper, no one answered. But I decided to go down anyway because, you know, it's Puerto Rico. So I went down. After 2 weeks, I said, I like it. So I told her, yeah, just, let's stay. So they moved us down, and I put my ad in one of the restaurants there, my resume, rather, for work, and they hired me as a chef. And for the first time in my life, I used my mother's last name. all Latin countries, you're required to use your mother's last name.
And your own name, right?
Your own name, but your mother's last name is your name. You know, I'm Henry Morales, and then ballet is my mother's last name. So all names, your mother's and your father's last name is used. And so someone recognized this name. And I said, well, I know this person doesn't know me. Here's my mother's name. Take it to this person and see what happens. The next day I got a phone call. Hola, mi primo. You know, it's like, hello, my cousin. It's my first cousin. You know, and I couldn't wait to get off work to go see this person, you know. And when I went to go see him, he opened up his door, and right away we looked at each other. We said, oh, wow. And we grabbed each other, and I found my mother's history. You know, that initially she came from Guadeloupe. But for some kind of political strife, they went to Puerto Rico, and she was raised in PR. You know, so little things started coming back to me. People saying that my mother spoke Spanish but had a funny accent or something, you know. French was her first language, sure. You know, and so, you know, it's like giving me a hold.
And you're becoming human.
I'm becoming human, right?
Right. You're moving away from that life.
I'm connected now. I'm growing roots. Mm-hmm. You see, and show me pictures of my mother's little girl. You know, it's just awakened stuff up in me. You know, and so that happened, and then my second wife. Which is where the real change and the real decision to change kicked in, was when I went to this thing called the International Black Summit, IBS. And they meet all over the world. This year they're meeting in Ottawa, Canada, you know. And for the first time in my life, I got in front of a mic. First of all, it was a weekend event. And whatever is holding you back, it's like the landmark. But it's for black people because there's soul right. in it and there's spirit in it, which is missing in Landmark, you know. So I heard maybe 10, 20 other people get up and, you know, and speak, and these people helped them out, you know, as individuals. And so I got up and I thought it was just going to be an easy little statement that I was going to make. And as I was waiting there to speak, and my whole body started trembling and I couldn't even control myself. And when they came to me and I was supposed to stand up to speak, I couldn't do it. And I asked, could I speak from sitting down, from sitting position? And they said, yes, you know. So then I spoke and I let this, I just spoke for quite some time and I let everything out, you know. And I was so emotional. And it seemed like 50 years of tears came out of me. And it was in front of everybody.
In front of this group that you knew,
yes,
would be,
about 300 people,
and they were, but they were going to be accepting of yes, your realness. You
right.
know that.
Yes.
The you first know. Thing that you said to them, do you remember?
I don't even remember.
But
it
he
was just
you
so
are.
Much.
He you know? Are the human.
Yes.
Henry Morales is now talking,
and I was accepted.
And accepted, yeah.
You know, and
how did it feel? How did you feel the idea of me calling you up and saying, "Would you come in and do a radio program with me?" How did that, when you heard me on the radio, when he heard me call you
oh,
for this?
I said, oh, okay, I'm on. You know, he read it, and there's
see a perfect
something
circle
in there.
To this. Yeah.
Yes, you know. And, so
from this point on, Henry, what's your plan from here?
What I do every day is I try to uplift every and anybody who comes in my direction. Anybody I touch, I try to give them a boost. Talk to a lot of young people. Let them know that this is not it. This is not everything, you know. And you never know where or what's going to lead you to somewhere else. You know what's going to take you. I just got love for everybody and everything. You know,
I got you.
And you can dig deep inside yourself and find yourself. You'll see a different vision of everything that happens to you. And most of this has been done because I've done solitary confinement and that sort of thing. You need like there's a reason why in all religious books, you know, and that's all they are to me, just religious books. But these people who are prophets, there's a reason why all of them go off by themselves and meditate on their own, because it's something that you have to do on your own. No one can do it for you to find who you are and your center.
Thank you, Henry, for being with us. To imagine how this all started with your hearing my voice somewhere in a prison cell in Elmira or wherever it was, and From there, it carries you through to whatever you've done in life, including making the donation to WBAI. And then, on top of that, you make the donation and you come and you meet with me, hand me a copy of your book, which I get a chance to read, invite you on the air. Did you ever think, for a moment, when you were sitting in that cell in Elmira, and you were listening on the radio, that one day you'd be here sharing what you know with so many other people around the world? Well, thank you for being with us, Henry. Is it admirable? That's a question. No, it just is. It's the way it is. 212-757-4488. We need you to go to your phones and represent the station. 212-757-4488. For a $200 donation, you get a one-time meeting with me, Armand DeMille, personally. Will explore the way you've gone through your journeys. 212-757-4488. And maybe there's some additional help I could give you. Getting through life is difficult for some people, much more than others. For Henry Morales and the people he lived with and the people of the streets, it's a very difficult time out there. Very difficult time. And you make choices. There are some choices where you say, I've got to be here and I feel a part of my environment and the people around me. And there's one that says, I'm alienated. I'm separate. I could do whatever I feel like doing. And what does it matter? Henry Morales made a very important point when he said, look, if I commit a crime, what can I do with that crime? They're going to put me back in prison. I've been in institutions most of my life, so that's the worst that happens. Or he said, they may kill me. And he said, so how bad could that be? And those are the choices that we hear. How bad could that be? This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind. Here on WBAI, we're able to bring you some of the information, thoughts, that you wouldn't get anywhere else in the world. And we're asking for your support and your help. If you make a $75 donation to the station by calling 212-757-4488, that's 212-757-4488. My staff is standing by right now. We have four people ready to answer the phones as you call, and it would take you, it may take you a little while, you may get a busy signal, but whatever it is, just persist. 212-757-4488. Show your support for The Positive Mind, show your support for WBAI, show your support for the importance of the work that we're doing here. 212-757-4488. Remember, Henry Morales first learned of us by listening to WBAI while in prison. And there certainly has been enough work done by WBAI for people in the prisons. 212-757-4488. Support it. Support the station however you can. Now, for a $75 donation, you get a signed copy of the book by Henry. 212-757-4488. We are also offering, for a $200 donation, if you make a donation of $200, you get a one-time meeting with me. 212-757-4488. Make your calls right now. Represent your neighborhood. Represent your group. 212-757-4488. I'm asking you to support what we are doing. Now, we're going to be gone. We won't be around WBAI for a couple of weeks because we've got some programming and we're going to be off doing a couple of things. We will be back with you in just 2 weeks with another special we're doing on addictions and excesses. And that's going to be a fabulous thing. That's scheduled for 2 Wednesdays from now. Make a note to yourself. 212-757-4488. But for right now, what you can get for a $75 donation, the book by Henry Morales, Journey of a Man, signed copy sent to you. And for a $200 donation, the one-time consultation with me personally, Armand DeMille. I would love to meet with you. It's always rewarding for me to meet you. And so far, there are very, very few complaints about anyone who's ever come here to meet with me. 212-757-4488. 212-757-4488.
And that's the number where you'll reach us here at the office, and we'll be answering those phones, 212-757-4488. And again, $75 contribution for the Henry Morales book called Journey of a Man. And this is the book written by the man that we just interviewed here. And this money goes straight to WBAI and their recovery. So, as always, $75 contribution for the book, for Henry Morales' book, and a $200 contribution for a one-time consultation with Armand DeMille. 212-757-4488.
That's 212-757-4488. We're waiting for your calls right now, my friends. I hear the phones ringing. We have lines, a couple of lines open, and we have people standing by. 212-757-4488. When you call, my friends, you'll be speaking to some of these lovely people that I work with. What a wonderful opportunity. You'll speak with Jamie Ross or Audrey Clark or Alexander Rivas or my cousin right here, if he happens to be grabbing phones as well. You're going to take some phone calls too, aren't you, Julian?
Yeah, I mean, if you don't need me, I'll be taking phone calls.
212-757-4488. Make your calls right now, my friends. You beautiful people, the beautiful people you'll speak to. Make your donation. We're here at WBAI 99.5 FM. 212-757-4488. That's the number at my office. It's different than the call center that we've been offering because we have found that we get much more effective results from taking the calls ourselves. Our staff is here. They take the calls. They're faster. So you can make your calls and you're going to get people picking you up right away. 212-757-4488. We look at heroes and do-gooders as a special sort of breed. People who possess extraordinary traits of altruism or less self-concern for the well-being of others, even at the expense of their own existence. On the other end, sociopaths have an extraordinary set of traits such as extreme selfishness, lack of impulse control, no respect for rules, and no conscience. So they sound quite opposite, don't they? As crazy as it seems, there may be a closer link than you think between the extreme altruistic personality and the sociopathic personality. Sociopathic, their personality defined as the one that doesn't have guilt or remorse and could do just about anything without feeling bad. Would it shock you to know that two people, one with the traits of extreme altruism, which we're going to call the X-altruist, with the capital X, X like the chromosome, not the XEX, and the other traits of the sociopath are related, and that their personality traits are very similar with only a few features to distinguish them? There was some research done by Watson Clark Kamilowitz from the University of Iowa. They said, personality has consistently shown to be extremely heritable. However, the same genetic material arranged and weighed in a slightly different way may at times express as vastly different phenotypes. The extremely good and the extremely bad individual are just one tiny DNA molecule separation. How is that possible? You'd think it has to do with nurturance. You'd think it has to do with how you grow up. Maybe it's your parents. At a first glance, one would be compelled to put the sociopath and the ex-altruistic, that means the over-altruistic person, on opposite ends of a personality scale, the hero, right? The hero versus the sociopath. The hero who sacrifices his life to try to save a child dying in the water who was thrown in over the car wreck. And the sociopath who says, who aimed the car in that direction, right? After all, the chance of a serial killer running into a burning building to save a child is pretty slim, right? And wouldn't it be a hero type, be one of the last people likely to break the rules? Wrong. Someone who goes out of their way to help others, even at the expense of their own welfare, is actually more likely to break rules than the average person. The average do-gooder you know is a rule breaker. Isn't that interesting? But wait, they're always trying to do good. But they break a lot of rules. They have, and you're going to see, as you think about some of the do-gooders you know, they've got a part of them that's really kind of risque. Whatever that means. Think of, you remember Dr. Ross from the early days of the TV show ER? Constantly pushing limits, breaking the rules, throwing caution to the wind, all for the sake of the child patient. Even when it ultimately meant he was getting fired. Or on 9/11. After it was apparent that the buildings were about to collapse, teams of firefighters were called back. Yet they disobeyed orders and pushed on anyway, only to perish in the quest of possibly saving one more life. Is that a hero? Why are they breaking the rules? Weren't people trying to save them? Those are the actions of a hero, or what we call the ex-altruistic personality type. But consider the type of rule-breaking that the hero engages in. Would you classify it as a criminal or even unlawful? How does motive factor in? So when you think about some of your heroes, they're breaking rules all the time, unlawfully. So now, how do we admire them and then criticize the one who breaks the rules for their own benefit? So if you break the rules to save a child, that's okay. But if you break the rules to steal some money, that's not okay. Very interesting. People whom we consider to be heroes, while among some of the most admired individuals, possess many of the same characteristics as a sociopath. However, there's a fundamental difference in the motivation behind the actions that distinguish them from their supposedly nasty cohorts. Incidentally, that one difference is virtually important in determining if someone turns out to be a comic book hero or more like his arch enemy. You know, in the comic books, who's the hero, who's the arch enemy? The one little difference. What's that little difference? Who are they doing it for? Heroes are compelled to be good, even when they're doing so makes no sense and brings harm upon themselves. You know, I shoot him, I can't shoot him. I'm going to arrest him and bring him to prison instead. That's what the hero says. They cannot tolerate injustice. They go to extreme lengths to help those who have been wronged, regardless of their personal relationship to them. Now, I'm not speaking of the guy who helps an older lady cross the street. I'm speaking of the guy who throws himself in front of a speeding bus to push the lady out of the way, killing himself in the process. The average, kind, thoughtful person does not take these kinds of extreme personal risks on a regular basis. Is this man sane? Is this man saner? I remember once meeting a woman, a very famous woman, and she told me she got in an elevator with a guy, and guy held a gun to her, and he said to her, I want to get into your room, where he was going to rob her and abuse her. And she said, I'm not going to let you in my room. She faced him right down. She says, you're not going to shoot me. She was 65 years old, and she was feeling pretty rotten. And so he backed out, and he got off, and she came to the party where I was, and she was boasting about how proud she was that she wasn't going to get shot. But I could tell you something. There is nothing she would have welcomed more in the world than to have had her life end right there. Her husband had just died. She didn't know what she was going to do. So she was, in effect, asking him, please shoot me. But everyone, of course, considered her a hero because she resisted. The word hero conveys images of people like Mother Teresa or Gandhi. Passive, extremely selfless people. They're altruistic, true, but the real altruistic person is anything but passive or meek. They're feisty, argumentative, independent, idealistic risk-takers, and they're convention-breakers. Sounds sort of like the sociopathic personality, right? Let's take a look at these. Let's compare the two. What's called a sociopathic personality? Let's look at their characteristics. Number one, low impulse control. Well, let's look at the altruist, the hero. They have low impulse control, right? They see something, they've got to act on it. Number two, high novelty seeking, right? And that's for the person who is a sociopath, right? They're looking for novelty. They're looking to get excited. Well, for the hero, it's the same thing. Looking for something to turn me on. no remorse for their actions, which is a lack of conscience. And for the hero, it's little remorse for their actions because they say, I'd do it again in a heartbeat. How did you run into that burning building to save that dog? I'd do it again in a heartbeat. What, are you crazy? Another characteristic that they share is the willingness to break rules. Well, of course, the hero is willing to break rules and always acts in the interest of himself, which is what the sociopath does. And here's where the difference is. It is the hero always acts in the best interests of others for the, quote, common good because it's the right thing to do. Now, both the heroes and the sociopaths have high impulsivity, need for novelty, the tendency to break rules. And there's a fundamental difference in the motivation driving their behavior. This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind. A little earlier today, we've heard a story about a man who clinically could be called a psychopath, could have been defined as just about most people who get into the prison system can be. It's just a word, but it's a word that means no regrets, no remorse, and they can easily go from one to another. They can go from being criminals of the world to heroes of the world in their own kind of way. I'm trying to get you to understand that there is something about this personality that you kind of step back at and you look at and you understand. And when you do, it makes it easier not to get pained by any kind of interactions. Someone who is a hero is always looking to the idealistic good situation or the way things should be in a fair and just world. And even if they're not a hero, if they're altruistic, they're always looking for the just world. But you know, the funny thing about a sociopath, think of the movie Taxi Driver. He's always thinking about the just world as well. He wants to get you to the just world. This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind here on WBAI 99.5 FM. We're going to take a short break. And when we come back, I'm going to continue with this part of understanding what we're doing here today, which is understanding the streets, understanding life in the streets. And I'm talking about both the people who are the most criminal of people and the people who are addicted to being good. The psychopathology of heroism. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes.
If you donate $200, Armand will contribute a one-time consultation with you, in person or by phone.
I've seen many people come in for the consultations, and they felt very positive about the experience. Here's some of the responses I've received by email. Susan wrote, "He gave me insights and tools to keep growing and learning. It felt like we'd been working out our issues for years."
We received an email from Ed, who said, "He is a real man that knows how to treat another man as a man. He gave me a feeling of being cared for, all to get me better on track with myself."
Tina wrote, "My relationship with my children has changed. I am experiencing being more present, real, and connected with them."
Theo wrote, "His way of engaging me to view myself was quite disarming and safe. I felt as if whatever I said, he had heard it before and was okay to express and explore. Meeting Armand in person was comforting and smooth."
Muriel wrote, "He fit my needs and feelings together with his insights to create a plan for me going forward to improve my life. I felt beyond anxiety free. I felt relieved and happy. I finally knew what direction to go in."
So to get this one-time consultation with Armand for $200 donation, you'd call 212-757-4488. 212-757-4488.
That's 212-757-4488. 212-757-4488.
212-757-4488. And that's the number you'll call, and we'll be picking up the phones very soon. And call now. It's the $200 donation to help the station get back on their feet.
212-757-4488. 212-757-4488.
212-757-4488.
I'm standing by at the phone for your call, 212-757-4488. I'm looking forward to hearing from you. That's 212-757-4488.
212-757-4488. And that's the $200 one-time consultation with Armand DeMille. And that's going to go directly to WBAI. So 212-757-4488.
This is Jamie Ross. I'm standing by for your call at 212-757-4488, and I will be assisting you in your contribution and consultation.
And this is Julian Joiello, and we're going to be waiting here to get your phone calls. 212-757-4488. Make your call now.
212-757-4488. This is Audrey. I'll be right here waiting for your call. 212-757-4488.
Armand DeMille back with you. We are talking today about the psychopathology of both the sociopath, the psychopath, and heroism. Very often you'll hear a person who has been somebody who's lived a criminal life turn around and become someone who's a preacher and just kind of preaches the good life. Okay, fine, that's great. Just understand that there's a very strong similarity between the two. And according to the researchers, there's enough genetic information to suggest that they're just one small allele, A-L-L-E-L-E. There's one small chromosomal shift between the person who's one way and another way. So you take a look. So as I was saying, both the heroes or the altruists and the sociopaths have this high impulsivity. They're both very impulsive. They both have a need for novelty. Think about the do-gooders you know. Think about how thrilled they are by novelty, by impulsivity. Think about their tendency to break the rules. It's a funny thing. One of the things that they showed about the do-gooders is they had earlier sexual experiences much earlier than most people did, because they're rule breakers, and there's something about the sexuality which is kind of interesting to them. It's more intriguing. And it's a way of serving. It's a way of making a person feel good. Someone who is altruistic is always looking for the idealistic good situation or the way others could be in a fair and just world. So when it came to Occupy Wall Street, you had a mixture of people. And I was listening, I was seeing, and I was talking to a group of people, some of whom were fine people dedicated to the well-being of mankind. And there were other people there who were, by my definition, of questionable authenticity. One day I was with somebody who I saw throw paint on somebody who had an artificial fur coat, thinking it was a real fur coat. But in throwing that paint, they got the paint in the person's eye, and the person was really hurt. They had to rush the person off to a hospital with paint in their eye. And I thought to myself, well, what is this now? Is this a do-gooder? Or is this a psychopath hidden under a do-good cause? Hey, how dare I speak? Here we are at WBAI, where we do more good than any other place that I could imagine. Who knows? Maybe I'm one of those guys. But anyway, what is the truth about the psychopath? What is it about the sociopath? They are someone who is idealistic in their own kind of way. They look for a good situation. They want to be in a fair and just world, and they talk about that all the time. They're able to empathize, feel what the other person is feeling, and imagine themselves in another's shoes. Now, who is that, the hero, the altruist, or is that the psychopath? Well, the psychopath can empathize also, and they can get themselves in your shoes. Of course they can. That's how they manipulate people. The empathy is a force that moves them to engage in heroic behaviors or in psychopathic or sociopathic behaviors. We listened to our guest talk about what happened when he stood up in front of a store attendant with a gun held to the other guy's head. And luckily, he never had to shoot anybody in that condition. But he would have, as he said, well, wait, no, it's you between you. You are between me and my money, the money that you're going to give over to me. So, and if it means you're going to give me trouble, I would shoot you. Because that's the way I feel. And that is the way that mind works. So to be able to read a book that spells that out so clearly is really a beautiful thing. I am very impressed by it. I'm impressed by the reality of it. The sociopath, on the other hand, is motivated by internal factors, selfish desires, and the advancement of their own cause, rather than the cause of others or society as a whole. So the hero or the altruist is looking for the cause, everybody else's cause, and the psychopath is looking for their own cause. They don't have the ability to empathize as much, but they do empathize because they have to be able to read what you feel so that they could react to whatever reaction you're having. One of the things that we learned from Henry Morales is that he became very keen on how another person was feeling, and that's how he stayed out of trouble as much as he did. Everything that they do is driven by the quest to satisfy their needs rather than the needs of another person, whereas with the hero, they're looking to satisfy the needs of the other people and not themselves. If an altruistic person is able to empathize and is thus motivated to help others, there is a level of there's a heroic level of it where they have too much empathy for others, driving them to break rules and put themselves in harm's way in order to alleviate the suffering of others or bring fairness to the world. When you have someone who is willing to try to serve others by breaking the rules as strongly as possible, then we have the question. I think about some of the things that some of the producers here at WBAI have done, where they put their bodies at risk to serve others. How do I know what's the difference there? Are you putting your body at risk because you want to put your body at risk, or are you putting your body at risk because it's the only way that you could serve? Interesting, these two types of individuals, the sociopath and the hero, may appear similar in their displays of behavior. At times, they get even confused for a type. When you meet somebody who's a psychopath, if you look at them like, I think, Oliver North, when you kind of look at Oliver North, you say, oh, what, you could see him as an altruistic person trying to serve the nation and serve God and serve country. There's even some past presidents you could look at that way if you were looking from a distance. If the person is compelled to break rules without remorse in order to help a disadvantaged person, it may mean that this is just an act of rebellion. On the other hand, a real hero would be able to move within the rules to help people and would dedicate themselves to a slower process, I think. This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind. So while the altruistic person indeed acts for the goods of the people, he often violates laws, breaks laws, or otherwise causes ripples. To be a good citizen, we're required and expected to follow the law at all times. But we can all agree that the world needs extreme heroes. They're the ones who constantly go above and beyond the call of duty, even when it means losing their job, receiving hefty fines, or even serving time in jail. But are they really criminals? Or do we need to bend the rules of time in order to allow for those types of do-gooders to continue on their path, bringing righteousness and justice to an otherwise corrupt world? Where do we draw the line between criminality and heroism? Here's an even better question for you. How exactly do we support necessary rule-breaking for virtuous intent, yet punish malicious rule-breaking for ill intent? How can it be done? Maybe someday we'll be able to write public policy that actually serves the best intent of the people. And if it means that once in a while some rules need to be broken in the process, that's okay. I want to send a message to all of you, all of those heroic altruists out there, continually putting your butts out on the line for the well-being. Thank you. This world is a better place because you dare to be good, even when it seems crazy to do so. But sometimes, please don't be too crazy in doing so, because it works against you. This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind here on WBAI 99.5 FM, bringing you some aspects, personalities about psychopathy, sociopathy, and heroism. We're going to have to be going right now, and if you want to get further information, you could go to the website, thepositivemind.com, and you could listen to any of the archives there. Make your calls right now, my friends. We'll be back with you in 2 weeks, specifically
August 7th.
August 7th, thank you very much. Mm-hmm. On Wednesday at 1 p.m. with 2 hours about excesses and addictions. It's going to be a very, very interesting program. 212-757-4488. Bye-bye for now, my friends.
Two one two seven five seven four four eight eight. 212-757-4488. 212-757-4488.